You talking to me?
Well, yes, you and everyone else that's listening, Robert.
Do you have any idea how fucking busy I am?
No, but do you know how busy we are producing 6 high-quality podcasts?
I got a boner.
Okay. All Things Film, 6 of the best high-quality free podcasts on the internet. No, they are, really. Film Freaks, daily Grindhouse podcast. It was only £1. Mass Movie Site UK, the podcast on Fire Network, and of course, Filmsploitation, the All Things Film podcast. All available to download free from allthingsfilm.co.uk and from iTunes. Really, you should get that cough scene to it. Could be something serious.
We're tonight's entertainment.
No, Joker, we're tonight's entertainment. And every night, on iTunes, on Stitcher, on TuneIn, and available from www.allthingsfilm.co.uk. What's the website address again, Chewbacca? So sit back, subscribe, and enjoy.
I do wish we could chat longer, but I'm having an old friend for dinner. Bye.
Welcome to Podcast on Fire 183 on Encounter of the Spooky Kind and A Better Tomorrow 2. And we take a look at when the combo of martial arts, horror, and the supernatural clicked. Like the genre bender, if you will, finally clicked. And that comes in the form of our discussion on Sam Holmes' Encounter of the Spooky Kind from 1980, aka Spooky Encounters, I think, was Spooky Encounter. I'm using the title from the original print, by the way, Encounter of the Spooky Kind. It's usually known as Encounters of the Spooky Kind. I think it works either way, to be honest. I don't think that's a grammatical error, but whatever. And we're talking the sequel to one of the most iconic Hong Kong action pictures of all time, John Woo's A Better Tomorrow 2. And I'm Kenny B, and with me is Tom KW. So say hi, buddy.
Howdy doody.
Howdy doody. How are you doing, buddy?
Yeah, I'm good, man. Not too bad. How's yourself?
Not too bad. Not too bad. Podcasting left and right, creating new shows, putting up new shows.
Oh, I have seen your work. Are you going behind my back, Kenneth? Oh.
Well, you've never shown any interest in Richard Harrison and brightly colored ninjas.
They are great.
I've heard you say poofed, poofed.
Five stars.
Five Richard Harrison ninja
for
stars.
For the franchise. 5 stars for the franchise.
Richard Harrison rocks, and that show was very fun to do. And the Golden Ninja podcast is what we're referring to. That is on our site, podcastonfire.com. This is Podcast on Fire, a flagship show. And we have tons of other shows and bonus episodes on there. Pick and choose and see if anything catches your eye and interest. And let us know if you like any of the show or if you have any constructive criticism or questions on podcastonfire@googlemail.com, the ye olde email. You can also use Facebook. I heard, by the way, the kids don't use Facebook that much. Facebook is kind of out.
Facebook's out now.
Yeah, it's like Snapchat and shit.
You know? Oh, yeah, we need to get a podcast on Snapchat.
You know, Snapchat. Like, how do we do it? Like, so when I first say welcome, I do a Snapchat. Or, hey.
Snapchat of you just kind of pulling, you know, tongue out of the mouth normally is what the kids are doing. But yeah, I mean,
like
that
5 Snapchats in, I'll take my dick out for some reason.
Yeah, that would not be beautiful, the boss Snapchat.
Oh, what the hell? What are you saying? It's not really beautiful. But I heard that in actuality, when I got my hair cut like a week or two ago, we talked about social media and what have you. And my hairdresser is one of the kids is like 10 or 11, so he's or she is social media savvy. And it's clear from like, doing a poll, so to say, that Facebook is kind of out. Kids don't really use Facebook anymore. So if we had a kids' audience, then we've lost them.
but firstly, you get your hair cut by a 10-year-old. And secondly, yeah, it's out. Facebook's dead. No. It's done. The way
10-year-old's brother.
Okay.
the mother, obviously.
Okay.
Don't you? You know what I mean. I'm not. We're not Stone Age in Sweden or like progressive. Like we let the kids cut the adults' hair. But...
they're just banging like pebbles on your head until your hair falls out. Yeah. That is how they do it. We've got the podcast on fire, Bebo, and the free webs. We've got both those coming for you. There's plenty of pictures and text. So that combination, I'm sure, is there's something for everyone. Pictures, text. Do you know what I mean? Everyone.
We're going back to modem times where a picture of a woman that's possibly nude would load for about 10 minutes. Like slowly. There might be boobs. God damn it! It's not even pornographic at all. It's like a girl from the catwalk in Paris.
Standing behind a wall. Just the neck up, like shit.
But, okay, we are on Facebook.
The film scan. The Facebook. Go on, go.
It's not snapchat.com/POF network. It's facebook.com/POF network. Like our page, we recently got our 300th like, and it may sound little, but we got a steady increase in likeage, and I appreciate that. So,
Gerard Butler took my penis, all right? We got 300. Yeah, you think you got 300? No,
I thought that was like a random shout-out. Like, what's wrong with Gerard Butler? That guy's funny.
Yeah,
that's like 300. Okay, I get it. I never saw that movie, but I know Gerald Butler. I've seen him in interviews. He's fun, but that's all I know of him.
This is true. Baby G and his CGI abs. He's out. He's old news now.
Are they really CGI?
But I don't know. I think some people had them a bit CGI'd. Yeah, I think. I don't know.
Maybe he wore like a green screen.
Like there's a bit going on there. CGI kind of, you know, buffery going on. Right. Insane.
All right.
Don't hold me to that.
Is Gerald Butler with the kids? I don't know, but regardless, click and like our page and
it's down.
Very much down.
Very much down.
It's down from 300 to whatever number.
150.
Yep. And also join the discussion group if you want to find out updates and join the chat and have a good old time. Follow the link on facebook.com/POF network or type in Podcast on Fire Network in the Facebook search box to reach that group. Tweet us and follow our tweets at twitter.com/podcast on fire. I do writing of various movies, category free movies, Taiwanese black movies, ninja exploitation, and short bite-sized reviews of a varied amount of genre movies akin to our movies for this episode. SoGoodReviews.com, and I also do video reviews at sleazykvideo.com, and I tweet at twitter.com/SoGoodReviews. Rate and subscribe to Podcast on Fire on iTunes. You can do that through the big Podcast on Fire network feed, but there's obviously a feed for just Podcast on Fire. And if you like the show, please leave a little written comment if you have the time. That would very much be appreciated. And if you don't like downloading podcasts to your preferred device, there is Stitcher. You can stream us online, but you can also stream us through your iPod, probably your iPod, because I think there's an app for the iPod Touch and what have you, but through your iPhone, iPad, and Android. And that's Stitcher. And of course, if you want to find us on Stitcher, type in Podcast on Fire, and that'll get you a latest search results and the option to add us to your favorites list. Tom, thecinemashow.com, it's a site you're active on every now and again. I heard a little Tweety Bird talk about that Tom maybe potentially is thinking of potentially maybe writing something, potentially.
Possibly, potentially, maybe, possibly. No, there's the latest review was Accident. That went up a couple of months ago. Check that out if you don't have already. There's another review coming up, hopefully, next few weeks. There's a tentative link between the two films, Accident and the one I'm about to review. Take a guess. Could be anything. You don't know. But it'll land next couple of weeks, hopefully. We'll see.
It's Hong Kong, I presume?
I'm not going to tell... Yeah, it's Hong Kong.
It's not really the end of the usual suspects. It's like, what is it? What's he going to review?
Yeah, it's probably Hong Kong. Yeah, it's going to be Hong Kong.
At thecinemashow.com, you have a review archive there, and the site is filled with news and reviews of various movies across Asia and what have you, so check that out. We are taking a small promotional break, and after that, we are chatting about The Encounter of the Spooky Kind from 1980, and let the hate on the classic begin. But not really, so see you after the break.
The following message is a paid advertisement for the Cult of Muscle podcast. The Cult of Muscle, you're either in it or you're dead.
It's the dawning of a new age. The halls of Valhalla have been shuttered.
The heroes of yore have either retreated to the shadows or taken to capering for the amusement of the small folk, their past glories a distant memory. The barbells have been torn from their once puma-strong grips. The beards shorn from their square jaws, only to be transplanted onto flannel-clad, puny weaklings with fingers barely powerful enough to strum a ukulele. The time has come, my brothers, to restore order from the chaos. No longer will our heroes be forgotten. No longer will their great deeds be viewed through a foggy lens of irony. Hear now our rallying cry as we scream it from the mountaintops, as we bellow it from iTunes and Libsyn and Facebook. It's time to join the cult, my brothers. So don your cloaks and enter the cult of muscle.
Welcome back, and we are going to talk Sammo Hung's Encounter of the Spooky Kind from 1980, and plot from the Hong Kong Digital Review of the film Loudmouth Braggart, Bold Chung, played by Sammo Hung, who also directed, is actually anything but. In fact, he's a blithering coward under the thumb of his shrill, bitchy wife, played by Leung Shut Moi, who's having a secret affair with Tam, played by Wong Har. Powerful politician. When Chung almost catches the pair in bed together, Tam gets worried about his image being sullied. He decides to have Chung killed and enlists the aid of wizard Chin Hoi, played by Peter Chan Lung, to do the deed. Setting up a trap, Chin's friend Fa Kao, played by Wu Ma in a small role, bets Chung that he cannot live up to his nickname and spend the entire night in a haunted temple. Chung agrees to the wager, but on his way to the temple, he's stopped by Choi, played by Chung Fat, one of Chin's associates, the other wizard. Choi refuses to allow his sect to participate in such underhanded doings and instructs Chung how to spend the night in safety. And plot was actually longer, but I'll stop it right there. So we've established all the characters with different wizards, Sammo, even Wu Ma, and the shrill wife, and the politician, and therefore we've established that this is a, because that leads neatly into my brief opinion, that this is a cool, sharp mix of even dark horror, perfect comedy scenarios with clever, dark pushes into the supernatural and martial arts action. And Spiritual Boxer, the Lau Gollum film at Chow Brothers, might have ignited this genre bender a little bit, but this led the way, and Sammo is one of many examples of Sammo leading the way, even more so when he produced Mr. Vampire. And it's crazy how good Sammo Hung was for the development of Hong Kong cinema. And also, in short, it shot well. This movie comes with a sense of design and shot design. It's not a kung fu cheapie, and it feels common now. Like, we're familiar with the genre, but this still feels fresh, you know. Oh, an overstuffed genre didn't kill the elite efforts, and this is one of the elite efforts. I find nothing to complain about in this movie. I think this is nigh on perfect.
Wow, high praise indeed. Very high. How do I follow that? It's shit.
Yeah, it's offensive to me. Police story offensive to me.
I really like Counter Spooky Kind. I do find it a little bit all over the place, and I do slightly find it harder to digest than Dead and the Deadly, which is obviously Sammo's next stab after this, if you will, at a spooky martial arts romp. I find that film a bit more successful in terms of combining it, but it's great, and it's definitely, as you agree, there's a vision there, and there's kind of an adventure to it. It's not just kind of like, I mean, there's hardly concentration on martial arts and scrapping, really. It's more mostly just kind of on these spooky shenanigans that happens. But I mean, tonally, I do find it a bit, you know, awkward. It is a dark film. You know, the darker elements such as, you know, Sammo's wife's portrayal and, you know, a discovery of kind of what he thinks happened to her. And
now that you're on the dark dark aspect there, I mean, just look at the opening dream sequence. Talk about dark.
Yeah, I mean, it kind of opens and it's extremely dark, and I think it's one of those problems that we do get a lot in terms of kind of the comedy rears its head, and I think sometimes it just does spoil certain scenes for me in terms of the darkness really kind of washes over you with it, and it's kind of it sets up a certain vibe, and then it kind of, the comedy comes along a bit and kind of bangs you on the head a bit with it.
You must have seen worse examples of comedy trickling in.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely more schizophrenic examples in terms of going from A to B. You know, this at least is kind of A for a long time with only slight, you know, squirts of B almost. But
yeah.
I mean, yeah, on the whole, yeah, it's a very, you know, successful formula. I think I just prefer Dead and the Deadly.
Right on, and I think I prefer Spooky Encounters, but I really like Dead and the Deadly. It's a really, really entertaining, and as is this. I mean, that opening, by the way, is a dream sequence where two ghosts or spirits that are in these funeral urns, they attack Sammo. It's shot on this black soundstage, so it's clearly very surreal, and, you know, at one point, Sammo's kind of heel gets ripped out, and, you know, his blood spurting everywhere. He gets bitten, and then he falls out of bed eventually, and it's a dream sequence. But it's like, whoa, okay,
whoa.
Hardcore, here we go. And I never really have any complaints about the tonal shifts in this one. I think it's I don't complain because I think it's a lot of fun. Each mood is a lot of fun, you know. And I just like the aspect, for some reason, the aspect that tickles me the most is the fact that Sammo is daring Chung, you know, bold Chung. I am bold, I'm daring. And I know that sounds stereotypical, but it feels somewhat unusual to me. Like, I don't know, usually he's fatty, I suppose, and here's daring. And, you know, I'm the most daring daring one in town, la 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 la. I just find that amusing for some reason, that's his character, that he's daring. It's not martial arts king of the town, he's not the fatty of the town, he's daring.
Yeah, he almost plays on a second fiddle to kind of, you know, everyone else in the film. There's the majority of the film, it's almost like a buddy movie with Sammo and Chung Fat's character, which I do love, which is a nice role for him, as, you know, he spends the majority of his career playing heels, so it's great he gets a good guy role and you're playing against Sammo, no less. But yeah, it's almost like Sammo is not the hero of this one. It's almost like a backseat. He's kind of like the linchpin in terms of kind of moving the plot forward, but it's more the kind of characters that are on a kind of higher echelon than him, almost kind of, you know, make certain scenes happen. It's almost like, obviously, he's a bit of a puppet in the film, and strung along kind of a few times with it again, which is very kind of refreshing to see that it's not just him kind of in hero mode. It's a bit more different. A Sammo through and through, isn't it? There's no ego there in terms of he's always willing to make yourself look silly, always kind of willing to kind of play on his weight to, you know, for laughs. He's never afraid to do anything that, but. Yeah, so what makes him endearing?
And make his friends look good.
Yeah, oh, definitely. Yeah, he can do that.
As a producer and director, he literally made his friends look good and made them break and globally and what have you. Lam Ching-ying being kind of the chief one in terms of that when Mr. Vampire rolled along. And it should be said, I mean, Spiritual Boxer of a Shaw Brothers movie, it may have been sort of slightly first combining kung fu, supernatural shenanigans and comedy. Not a very successful movie. I thought it was quite uneven. Much has to do with the fact that I've never really been a great fan of the actor Wong Yu, not to be confused with Jimmy Wang Yu. This is a different actor. And Lau Golong's first movie as director, he's kind of still finding his footing. So it's quite uneven. Even the sequel is uneven as hell, as Shadow Boxing or Boxer. But the thing is, Hong Kong could do and had done horror, obviously, throughout the decade and even in the 60s, and certainly gothic horror and ghost horror. But there is something to be said for when Sammo is really on his A game. You know what I mean? That when he's dedicated to a mood, whether it's portraying Wing Chun in movies, whether it's, in this case, you know, doing a horror movie partly, and a comedy and a little bit of martial arts and some great martial arts actually, and mixing it all. I find it so inspiring. And this period in particular, I dare say, Tom, I'm wondering what you think of this, but this period, like 80 to 83 roundabout, it probably contains some of Sammo's best directed films. The confidence, I think, is at its highest, like Encounter of the Spooky Kind, Prodigal Son kind of period, you know what I mean?
Yeah, I think I'd agree with that. Yeah, I mean, this obviously, this you mean this kind of last kind of hurrah for the you know, authentic kung fu film before kind of moving into the modern age?
Well, I'm thinking of multiple genres, but really, I think this, I can even include Winners and Sinners into that. I think he's just very confident in his direction, and he's just an amazing filmmaker when you think of it. And again, this is not a kung fu cheapy, and I like the fact that, okay, we're doing horror here. Let's dedicate ourselves to that mood. And I think part of the movie is really scary. I mean, even the for heaven's sake, the scene where he's peeling an apple in the mirror, and he's the wager is that you know, he's not supposed to break the apple peel, and if so, some supernatural horrific things will happen. And it's kind of scary, but it's also very funny because his friends is out there creating, you know, wind and also appearing in the mirror as the witch, so to say, and like trying to fool him and scare him. But then it actually happens, you know, that it's true. The apple skin breaks and something does appear in the mirror, and something does snatch one of Samuel's friends. And I gotta say, I think I like Samuel's dedication to horror in this one. When he does go down the darker routes, it's very cool. Very cool.
I do, yeah. I think maybe it's that kind of heavier, darker tone that doesn't just work for me the whole way. I mean, I do like the film a lot, but I just think it's there's films kind of surrounding this, kind of as you said, that I think are a bit better and just work for me a bit better, because maybe they're just kind of a bit more. I don't know, lighter in tone, maybe they're a bit more kind of adventurous in tone. This film does get the darkness kind of bang on right, but in some ways just doesn't quite work for me the whole way. But I think it's that kind of black, it's definitely got that black comedy element to it as well, hasn't it? That it's, you know, you could interpret it as a lot of the scenes kind of are on that black comedy level in terms of they're not, you know, they're kind of, saying that they're not particularly abrupt, they probably work well within the film, but I think they're just on that kind of black comedy level, which I just possibly personally just does not work for me. But I do find a lot to enjoy in the film, and the action in particular, yeah, is kind of top notch.
Oh yeah, well, yeah, we'll certainly get to that. And I also like that there's no truly recognizable story beats here. You know, even today, this movie is kind of unpredictable. It's not this like, yeah, kill my master, train, then avenge at the tail end of the film. And I'm weak for stuff like when Peter Chanlung is performing at the altar, and how spells are done, and how objects are used, and people are possessed by gods at the end of the movie. And you know, it's a very cool creative onslaught that is that endures, you know, and throughout the movie, so well designed, but also well designed in terms of its characters. You know, just look at Peter Chanlung, just look at Chung Fat, who is this kind of quirky character, partly, but obviously very much a hero in the movie too. And Chung Fat in particular seems to enjoy himself greatly, inhabiting this shell, getting the character and costume design that he does get with the kind of thin facial hair, a thin mustache. And, you know, he's having a whale of a time, I think, and that's very cool and very inspiring to see.
Yeah, definitely, yeah. That's the one thing, you know, one thing I really do like about the film is that it's, you know, he's given a chance to really kind of shine as, you know, as, yeah, Samuel's buddy, and kind of he's almost kind of, he's a more cool-headed one of the duo, kind of like he knows his stuff kind of a bit more. He's always kind of knows where to go and what to do, where Samuel's, Samuel's bumbling, but he's very much kind of easy to be easily strung along by the rest of the characters. But that scene in particular, yeah, you were talking about the fight with the kind of possessed corpse about halfway through.
Yep.
It's terrific burst of energy. There's some nice tumbles, and the possession angle really allows some stuff to be a bit more high flying and an area than most of Samo's stuff, you know, at the time, you know, which is kind of grounded stuff. With this, they can kind of bring the wires in a bit and really kind of have some massive pulls and some, you know, flies without it being kind of too unrealistic. It fits perfectly with the film, and it has a great scene in the middle there.
Yeah, that remote controlling of the corpse of the hopping vampire, which is one of the more like scary looking hopping vampires of the genre, because it's more the face is more like a decayed face and what have you, and not just a blue face, and there's some black around the eyes and what have you. And I love the intercutting between Peter Chan Long trying to control the vampire and find Samo in the house. Yeah, he's sweating as hell, and Samo has obviously some countermeasures, like is it chicken eggs that is the wrong thing, or is it the duck eggs that's the wrong thing? But regardless, the merchant only provides him with partly the correct eggs for Samo to throw into the casket.
Yeah, off and off.
And I just love that, because when that vampire finally busts out of the coffin, and it's such great tension, but that Samo manages to do action choreography, complex action choreography with a stiff hopping vampire is kind of cool, because you have to have he does moves that are very stiff, but obviously because he is a corpse, and it's still very intricate choreography, and there's such a cool thing that whoever was in that suit, you know, it seems like really hard work to like be in character but adhere to Samo's like strict choreography and to get it right, you know.
Yeah, so you got to, you can't go for 100%. You've got to always have that thing in the back of your mind that, you know, you are a corpse and you got to be stiff and dusty and stuff. And then, you know, kind of, you almost would struggle to kind of, like, you want to put 100% into it, but you'd have to kind of, you know, rein yourself in a bit to kind of adhere to the character. So, I mean, yeah, it's very, very refreshing. Like, it's different kind of fights going on with different tempos and stuff. So, it's awesome.
And what else is there to say? I mean, obviously, the choreography is very well shot. You know, tons of moves in one frame and always shot clearly, and that's not something us old timers only like. I think it's such an enduring filmmaking style to shoot action clearly. But unfortunately, we're not in that era right now. You know, now it has to be moving along, and you have to be in the fight. You know, like, we have to be upside down and in the fight and shaking about.
Yeah.
I think John Crane said at one point, like, that doesn't make sense, because the way the camera moves means that your neck is, like, flying back and forth and will probably snap at one point.
Well, you're not a stiff object on a, you know, on some wheels, are you? You know, on a rig, you know, that's not you. You move like a dummy. You know, the human being moves kind of, you know, all this articulation, so it doesn't make sense at all. You're not this kind of square object kind of, you know, moving in and out of a frame. It's still shaking. It's crazy.
What do you think of Lam Ching Ying in this movie?
Yeah, I mean, I really like him. I mean, as always, he kind of shows up and it's just, he gets more of a, I mean, I wouldn't say kind of stern, kind of, it's a very serious part.
It's a very unreasonable cop.
I mean, it's very kind of like serious, kind of dead on, like kind of cop. So it's very interesting role, but he does kind of get let loose a bit, like towards the back end, which is
I think it's hilarious how unreasonable he is. You know, even when they bring in the guy who is Samo's only witness that he's holding on hope. Holding on hope that someone can clear his name. They bring in that witness. We have him here, but he's had a stroke. It's like, God damn it. So, okay, can he write? Well, he can write. So, did you see Chung at your stall? Because he's accused of murdering his wife. And he writes on the paper, and apparently the sign for yes and no is very similar. So he writes, and Lam Ching Ying pulls away the paper when it says no, and the guy keeps on writing, and they just ignore that. So I love he's so unreasonable, but he's also a coward. Lam Ching Ying is a cop, as it turns out. You know, that wonderful scene where he has to look good in front of his men and look down into a casket to find Samo, and he's afraid of finding a corpse. So in a wonderful comedy bit, Lam Ching Ying opens a casket, looks into it, and it's the casket Samo is in. Lam Ching Ying closes his eyes while he's doing it, and then shuts it. Cut to, wow! What a disgusting corpse, man! I love that. Wow! And Sam was looking so terrified, like, he's found me. Oh my God, yeah. He's closing his eyes. So, I mean, he was funny as hell under the Sam direction of Sam, or would be funny as hell in Dead of a Deadly, and would find his ultimate role in Mr. Vampire eventually. So yeah. We got these kind of free roles here that it's some key roles for Lam Ching Ying. So I absolutely adore that moment.
Yeah, it's great. And obviously the copycat scene with the obviously with the zombies is classic stuff as well. There's a lot of comedy kind of, you know, taken from that as well. You know, where Sammo kind of obviously tries to kind of trick it into beating his head with a brick, and he ends up just kind of like, because he thinks it's mirroring him, but obviously it's got a life of its own. It ends up just throwing the brick at him instead of like doing it, like banging it onto his head, mirroring him, which is
Yeah, apparently he has to sleep somewhere, Sam. Also, he's like, okay, I got this temple and there is a corpse here, so fine, I'll sleep next to it. And during the night, some kind of curse and spell has invaded that area, and the corpse is copying his every move. He goes to the toilet in the same way that Samu does, and they lay down and sit down. And yeah, as you said, he mimics everything, and Samu tries to... He throws a brick at himself, minds that he does that, and says, like, oh, but he sees through that.
He just drops house brick like, on his dick, doesn't he?
There are some theories that it's a Wu Ma under that.
It looks like Wu Ma. Definitely looks like Wu Ma. It looks like the shape of his face.
A little bit, yeah. I mean, it's a quite an extensive makeup job. They literally like baked a cake. on top of someone's face. But you can kind of see that it's Wu Ma, and obviously he's in the movie elsewhere, so he was around to an extent, I think. So, and I mean, this fear is about who was doing the stunt for the Hopping Vampire. I heard it's Yun Wai, I heard it's Yun Yu, and all is reasonable, obviously, because those two were around. They were kind of part of the Hungaban, if you will, the Samhung gang of action choreographers and actors and filmmakers. So
yeah, well, Yun Bo is action director, wasn't he? So he's not actually in the film, but he's listed as action director, so I'm pretty certain we can say it was him. Definitely around this time as well. It's got to be him. Anything that needed kind of a big jump or a big dive is like, just get all Union, get him in now.
Yeah, that's the working habit they had. Obviously, that you know, whoever's needed, then they'll do it, and they'll do it well. And for heaven's sake, I think Yun Bo has doubled for Sam on some occasions, which sounds mad. But I think that has kind of worked when acrobatics is involved. I think.
Oh yeah, we get men as women, and you know, we just go with it. It's Hong Kong cinema, you know, we love it.
But really, I mean, I know everything's not a highlight for you, but really for me it is. I mean, the supernatural and martial arts mix, I think, is so wonderful. You got the tea house fight where Sammo Hung's hat is possessed rather. And it's a wonderful piece of physical acting from Sammo, but I love when the spell is dropped, when Chung finally realizes, oh my God, it's gone. And he bursts into it. Chung is martial arts able, very much martial arts able. He's not a buffoon in that regard. And I love how Sammo just goes from, oh my God, it's let go, and then boom. I mean, it's really thrilling to see Sammo just let go and hard. The powerful Sammo choreography is here, as in many movies, it's here as well, which I always enjoy that. Working for Sammo is never a painless experience, clearly, and probably same here. So, do you think Sam Raimi saw this movie?
Oh, he's got it done. Yeah, definitely. I'm sure it's been, I don't know whether it's been mentioned along the years, but I remember reading somewhere, it might have been kind of, was it on, but possibly on like one of Jonathan Ross's shows he did in the 90s, was it the Incredibly Strange Film Show?
Mm-hmm.
Or I'm sure I've heard something or kind of seen something that maybe he said it on there, or kind of it was assumed that he'd seen it, but it definitely seems influential. I mean, just the kind of mixture of kind of goofy comedy, action, horror, kind of all kind of smushed into one. It's definitely got to be some kind of influence.
And I think, to be fair, Sam Raimi might have had Adam's Family and this movie in mind when he made his possessed hand kind of subplot in Evil Dead 2.
Yeah.
Because Sam Raimi is a great slapstick director too, and it's very much evident in Evil Dead 2. So I think it's very possible that Spook Encounters and Adam's Family was an influence on Sam Raimi, and a good way to like take inspiration and do your own art. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because it doesn't do a tea house scene in Evil Dead 2.
No, it's not in a tea house. You know, it's taking an element and yeah, kind of making it its own. It's taking an idea, isn't it? Which I think is obviously kind of the best. You know, kind of paying homage is always about when it's an idea. It's kind of reminds you slightly of it without kind of being shot for shots and image for images and kind of, you know, whole copied kind of ideas. It's cool when it's like that little kind of spark of an idea and makes it his own, and that's exactly, you know, what he did. He's got to have seen it. It's obviously, you know, my gripes aside with it, massively influential in terms of just mixing those, you know, two genres together.
Yeah, whole hell. And still, I mean, Mr. Vampire, I think, is more in the general consciousness, which is not a bad thing. But I think, and I hope, Spook Encounters is not far behind in terms of that. I mean, Mr. Vampire is a little bit more of a kiddie-friendly movie than this. I mean, at one point, this movie was rated 18 in the UK. It later got a 15 certificate. I think Mr. Vampire possibly has always been 15, but maybe Virtue Zone possibly could be 12 too, you know, if you really work on it. So it's a little bit less dark in that regard. Because the VHS I have that I first had of Encounters of the Spooky Kind made in Hong Kong VHS, that's 18. But the Hong Kong Legends DVD was when it was resubmitted, it was 15.
Yeah.
But no cuts, obviously.
Yeah,
I think 18 is quite harsh, to be honest. Yeah, I think it's just like the BBFC being quite harsh on any kind of bloodshed in the 90s. You know, they release it uncut, but it's got to be 18.
Yeah, changing times, definitely.
I don't know. I mean, the ending, you can say a lot about the ending. I just have this to say that it still has the abilities to surprise. When we got the wizards versus wizards, that uses their students, Peter Chan Lung's student, and Sam Hung is now Chung Fat's student, using them, and the gods are possessing them as well. And you got monkey style, you got ring fighting, you know, they use the rings, they use the spears. It's absolutely mind-blowingly cool, because I have a weakness for spears when the weapon is involved in a fight. It's just... Yeah. Mind-blowing how cool and fluent it is, you know?
Yeah, it's such a good finale, because we get all that. We get the fights, the ring fights are awesome, and yeah, the monkey stuff, although the sound effects are somewhat embarrassing. like that is, I mean, it's just a complete silliness, but it's great. And then you just get that final stunt as well, which is just magnificent, the fire stunt. I mean... Craig, the burning dead, it just misses Sammo by an inch. Like the timing on that.
It looks like it consciously is like, I'm going to make sure I move at the very last second.
The very last second, yeah. He's going to make sure that it looks perfect on camera. Yeah. It does. It just moves. The way it's shot and kind of from the certain angle, it just makes it look like he just skimmed him, or possibly just kind of like got him, and he's managed to kind of move out of the way. It's insane.
He must have been hot, at least, you know, that burst of warmth. So
definitely.
But yeah, it's a fairly serious ending though, and it has the ability to make you laugh too. But man, even the elder actor Wong Har, gets into the action. So obviously he's an elder actor that still has martial arts skills, and it just looks the fluent nature of it is absolutely marvelous. You know, dun 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 dun, and it's not overly cranked either. I mean, everything is cranked. I know that, but Sammo was a good had a good grip on, you know, frame rate and how to make it look fluent and fast without it being you know, a pinball game, you know, on screen, you know. But obviously they could bring it up to speed in real time, I think, to these performers. They were apt, to say the least.
Yeah, it's something you watch it and you kind of just you take advantage of it almost. You kind of don't realize that it's, you know, the way it's, you're almost just like, it seems normal, but you really think about it, it's just like, fuck, like, they were moving, like, you know, so fast and really going for it and keeping the, you know, keeping the energy up and keeping the kind of hits come in and cleanly and stuff is just crazy to think how much work's put into it. But that's always what you get with kind of Sammo Hung productions, always.
over and over again. You know, it was not just this one.
No, just all the way into the 90s, man. Like, all the way into the 90s. It's just still, like, no matter what the film's saying, like, no matter what the kind of the, you know, around it, what around the fight scenes is kind of about, or kind of the quality of that, it's always, the fight scenes just always there. You know, you never lost it.
Did you, I mean, I know you're a tad bit younger than me, but were you aware when this was screened on UK TV as part of a horror season, or you were too young to be around at that point?
Yeah,
it was on Channel 4. They had a horror season with this, Mr. Vampire, and possibly Chinese Ghost Story. Or
I've heard about kind of this, yeah, and this was kind of just before my time,
right,
in terms of that stuff, but I have heard that. For me, it was more when Hong Kong Legends burst into scene. That was one of my kind of experience. I collected VHS before, you know, maybe kind of a year or two before, but then it was kind of how to get Hong Kong Legends. When that arrived, that was when I arrived big time into it. And they showed bits and pieces on TV. I remember seeing Tiger on a Bee. I remember seeing Once Upon a Time in China four and five.
By the way, what was that movie you were referring to? Tiger on what?
Oh, Tiger on Beat.
Oh, I like that movie.
That's yeah, Once Upon a Time in China. I think 4 and 5, funnily enough. Mm-hmm. They showed a couple of other ones as well, yeah, which was, that was kind of my time. But I do remember, yeah, a lot of people have kind of heard about that prolific time when, yeah, Channel 4 showed a lot of these films.
It's a fantastic introduction. Obviously, Jonathan Ross has had something to do with introducing Hong Kong cinema to the UK public and still kind of champions it. I was always jealous that, you know, obviously programmers were, they weren't picking up random, like, crazy, stupid Asian shit. They were like, okay, so we know about these horror movies. One at least does. And these look good. We're going to buy a package and we're going to present it and we're going to be dedicated about it. You know what I mean? And it might have been just one season for like 1 week, but it has made an impression on UK folks over there. They remember that time. They were kind of introduced to Chinese Ghost Story and all these blue lit horror movies from Hong Kong through that season.
Yeah, I think a lot of people got into it via that kind of particular season, which is great. Yeah, and I mean, yeah, Jonathan, well, he has done a lot for me in the past, like I was saying, with the film show he did in the 90s, but he's a bit of a dick, but I think he does, you know, he goes out his way to kind of, yeah, let people kind of know about these films and kind of, you know.
It's the only part of Jonathan Ross that I kind of can endure. I think I don't particularly like his talk, to be honest.
No, I'm the same. I don't particularly like his dad's humor kind of thing. That's kind of my problem. It's I don't know. And there's no offense to dads out there. Like, you know, my dad's hilarious, but it's just that kind of dad, stereotypical dad humor. It's just like, oh, it's just cringe. But
I'm more of a Graham Norton kind of guy, to be honest myself.
I'm in same camp, man. Yeah, same camp. Same camp.
gay joke. So, by the way, my final note, you can do some more notes, random notes if you will, but if you see it on the print, it says written by Sammo Hung and Wong Jing. That's not Wong Jing. This is Wong Jing that spells his Jing with a Y. And it's a producer and director of movies like, he's done a few movies, among other movies, a movie called A Return of the Demon, which is a pretty fun one. Charlie Cho is in it. He's pre-Category 3 days. He turns into a dog in that one, which is a great sight. So that Wong Jing, more like sparse on the scene, so to say, but it could have been Wong Jing that we know of, because he wrote classic movies. He wrote some Hung movies as well, but so I had to double check that just to see which one it was. But it was the Return of the Demon director. So check that out. He made a movie called The First Vampire in China, which I enjoyed. So quite rare. But that's the end of my notes. Floor's yours, buddy. What do you want to say?
What did you think about the beating up of a certain female at the end?
I don't care about that stuff. You know what? The movie. I don't obviously enjoy, dark stuff on screen and kind of gleefully jump up and down in my couch like, yeah, rape, yeah, women being beaten. You know, I'm not like that. But I don't care of it's the ending bit, and Sammo beats up his wife after she fucked him over, and she did. And in the movie universe, it's fully deserved. Because she was an absolute bitch, and she wanted him dead. And Sammo has lost, I don't care if we're spoiling it, but Sammo has lost quite at least one friend along the way, died during the end. Yeah. So I mean, whatever. I mean, I'm not advocating it, obviously, but I don't think it's offensive or anything, to be honest.
No, I'm agree. I just wanted to get your opinion on that. But
I'm more offended of the stuff in Don't Give a Damn when people are walking around in blackface.
That's kind of a bit too much. Yeah, I suppose it's when you're going out to kind of, you know, assault, you know, kind of insult a whole race. Yeah, it's a bit different to kind of, you know, just. I mean, it's black and white. Well, literally black and white. But it's, you know, it's a different thing when it comes to kind of this stuff. I mean, it's not playful, but it's. I mean, she has a character's kind of a certain way, so I suppose I can move it in that direction rather than if it's kind of going against different kind of races. Then that's a bit, too much. But yeah, I mean, I just think it's, again, it's just that dark streak of the film. I don't know. I just can't. It's definitely got a lot more of a heavier, darker tone, and I find the comedy beats, but maybe it's just my taste. I think if you do like black comedy, I suppose it could be interpreted or enjoyed on that level. I just don't think I'm a massive fan. I do find a lot to enjoy in the film. I do like the film, but yeah, I just think there's the Sandler films I just enjoy a lot better than this one. But it is a classic, and it is influential.
Indeed, and that's a good note to go out on. And as for availability, the movie has its right with Fortune Star at the moment, and their distributor in Hong Kong at the moment is Cam and Ronson, who's put out the Blu-ray. No, here's the problem. As with a lot of their catalog titles, meaning of old movies, or maybe even all of their catalog titles, this may not be true high definition, but rather an upconversion from DVD to Blu-ray. And it looks like it also, based on specs, that it also features a remix only rather than original mono and a remix, which was probably true for the DVD. And Fortune Star remixes were nigh on terrible a lot of the time. They just redid sound from scratch, it sounds like. And it's not like the elements are lost or anything. It's just their excuse to, like, get the kids in. They might like it.
Yeah. I watched the 5.1 remix this time when seeing the film, just to kind of be strangely perverse to watch it. And they're just weird sound effects. Some hilariously out of place. It just feels like a different... I don't know why they do it, because it's the same about Tomorrow Too, just kind of having to flick onto the other channel. I don't understand. It just feels completely unauthentic. It just does not feel organic to that film whatsoever. It feels on top of the film. Yes. That's how I always feel. It feels like something's running at the same time, not with it. It's odd.
It's a company decision. It's like what's like good to have on a DVD? Like, we gotta have the Dolby logo because kids have surround sound system. Well, do that. And there's no thought or care that goes into them. Occasionally, remixes on Shaw Brothers DVDs and even the Hong Kong Legends remixes were kind of like, okay, just spread out the mono a little bit, but you can't create a home cinema fucking Transformers experience based on these movies. They were mono originally, and for heaven's sake, have your 7.1 EX DTS remix on there. But the mono, you know, on a Blu-ray especially, there's place for it, there's space for it. But unfortunately for the Blu-ray, it seems like it isn't there. My recommendation is try and track down either the... If there was an old DVD that had both sound options, get that. But I would also recommend trying to find the out-of-print Hong Kong Legends DVD of the film, which is very good. It has a mono and English dub and special features. And hopefully it doesn't go for, you know, £100 or anything after. So,
probably.
Really, are they so sought after, the Hong Kong Legends stuff?
So I've seen some of them go for like 40 quid, like ridiculous prices, absolutely ridiculous. But I think it's good because a lot of them were re-released with the magazine that came out. So I think a lot of them were re-released. I think they're kind of a bit easier to find. But I think you got to be careful, because I suppose if you're a collector and you're looking for the original Hong Kong Legends, the original releases that aren't the magazine versions, it's difficult because they're kind of all in together. There's no kind of clear separation from them. Do you know what I mean? So it's a bit difficult. But yeah, I'm sure you can get them I just check now, it's 38 quid new.
Right.
If you
want to guess, but yeah. Well, at least it's not 50, 60, 70 or whatever.
Well, £16 used. Do you know what? Just get Love Film and rent it. And Love Film, I want some money from that endorsement, thanks. I've been using your service for a few years now.
Right, so that's availability is good anyway, but if you need the Blu-ray desperately, don't pay a lot for it, to be honest. I haven't seen it, but I have a sneaky suspicion it's not HD, and it features only a remix. So, and it's you know, well, when we get to Be a Better Tomorrow 2 review, I listened to that remix for like 2 seconds. I nearly blew my brains out.
So bad.
It was the same thing. It was sound over sound, you know.
Yes.
Machine Gun sounds like it's out of a Call of Duty game. You know, it's so crisp and clear and doesn't mix with the movie at all. Like,
it's just wrong. The sound is like, you know, it literally is wrong. It's just the wrong sound. It's ridiculous.
All right, we're taking a promo break again, and after that, we'll be back to discuss Better Tomorrow 2, John Woo's follow up to his mildly successful. It certainly wasn't mildly successful. It was wildly successful and influential Better Tomorrow, and he did a sequel a year after that. So we'll chat about that in a little bit.
Odin's son, you have betrayed the express command of your king. Through your arrogance and stupidity, you have opened these peaceful realms and innocent lives to the horror and desolation of war! You are unworthy of these realms! You're unworthy of your title! You're unworthy! I now take from you your power! In the name of my father, and his father before, I owned it all, father! Cast you out!
Son of a bitch. Well, if I'm going to be stuck on Midgard for a while, I might as well make the best of it. Let's see. Grab a few beers, let's pop in a movie, and turn on this internet thing. Let's see what kind of trouble I can get into. If you're interested, check it out at podcast.sonofodin.net.
Welcome back, and let's talk about it tomorrow too, from 1987, a plot from the Far East Films review of the film, and any plot that we reference, we also link to those reviews, so if you're interested to check out the Hong Kong digital site and Far East Films, please do. It's years after the teaming of Mark Chai Fat, Ho Dick Long, and Kit Leslie Cheung. Ho is still in prison, and Kit is a prominent figure on the police force. Unbeknownst to Kit, Ho is approached by the police to investigate a good friend of his by the name of Lung, played by Dean Shek. This was my first Dean Shek movie, which is was an interesting journey.
First ever Dean Shek movie?
Yep.
Oh, okay.
And he is going to investigate his good friend, Ho that is, and he is released from prison to perform this task. In a deal gone wrong, Lung is framed for murder by his associate, his brother, the character of Go Jing Poi, played by Guan Shan, who is Rosamund Kwan's father. Actress, yeah. Rosamund Kwan's father. That's Guan Shan, the bad guy of this movie. So, and Lung has to flee to America to escape the authorities after this murder that he's framed for. Whilst he is away, his daughter is murdered, causing Lung to go temporarily insane with grief. Mark's twin brother, Ken, which is an excuse. Yes. Did you not know this, Tom? Because Mark is, I mean, now that we're talking of the sequel, Mark is dead. So his twin brother Ken, which is the excuse to bring Chai Fat back into a mix, is running a restaurant in the States and goes to Lung's aid. He helps Lung regain control of his life, and the two return to Hong Kong to team up with Ho and Kit to take revenge for his loss. So I had my brief, slightly longer opinions first in the first review. So let me have your brief opinion of Better Tomorrow 2 first.
Better Tomorrow 2. Wow. I feel like we've been building up for this review like from ever, for years since I came on. I feel like we've had to. It's been almost like you don't want to speak about it, but you have to speak about it. It's just such a strange.
Is it the elephant
film.
In the room?
It is. It's like we're talking about all these classics, and it's almost like Better Tomorrow 2. It's so weird because I feel like I do want to speak about it. Like I feel like I possibly might offend people because by calling it a piece of shit, I possibly might make people laugh at it.
Let me stop you there. You'll never offend people if you say your opinion. You'll only offend people if you say your opinion and claim that is the opinion everybody else needs to have. That is offensive, and you'll never do that, ever. Maybe you will now. Let's see.
Listen, everyone, you need to think Better Tomorrow is awful. If not, you're terrible. It's iconic, but it's a completely different beast to the first film and the third film for that matter. I'm going to appreciate it from my first view, but it's an overblown soap opera with some cracking, messy action scenes, but you can't escape the feeling that it's completely unnecessary.
I agree. I mean, here we go. You ask yourself that, or rather you come to the conclusion that, okay, it's understandable why it was made. Money and awards was hurled at it. But was it made for the right reasons? Seeing the final end product, they didn't have juice to make it for the right reason. You know,
What could they do? I mean,
I'm sure they could have done something, but it's kind of semi awful, to be honest. I like it for several reasons, but it's kind of awful, to be honest.
I just think, should we talk about the backstory before we actually physically get into the film? Like before we.
I've never really heard anything but a simple bite about that it had production problems, but maybe you know some more stuff than I know. So go ahead.
I probably kind of know what you kind of from reading the, you know, bits and pieces and commentaries and. You know, but I just think my personal take on it, after thinking about the film for many years and watching it kind of over the years quite a few times, my personal take on it is I have a strong feeling that John Woo did not want a part of this from the start. He's an auteur. He has a strong feeling of what he wants to create, and he creates it. I mean, especially in this period, this prolific period, and I'm talking when this film was made, peak time of kind of his creativity and what he'd go on to do. So I think, you know, thrown into something he doesn't really want to make, something that he obviously thought he'd put to rest with the main character, you know, dying in the first film. Mm-hmm. He's tried to at least put some creative stamp on it, some originality into the finished product, but without a consistent, strong vision for the sequel, it's boiled down to basically him squabbling with Choi Hark over kind of what should happen. And in the end, no one's got what they wanted. And I mean, it's a doomed project from its very genesis, artistically speaking, because what are you supposed to do with the first film? Like, how are you supposed to? It's not even like it's kind of like it finished on a cliffhanger. It finished on some way that we could put these characters back together. It's a thankless task, this film is. So I think to expect anything more than half-heartedness, you know, soap opera, comedy, unintentionally, you know, to expect anything more than that is kind of foolhardy, but I think it was just doomed from the start, and that's my personal view on, I think, how John Woo works, and kind of from his filmography, and he just seems like he's a director, he takes control, and he knows how a film wants to look, and I think with this, he just seems like he maybe just didn't want a part of it from the start. That's my personal take.
I heard that this might have been a rumor that they were aiming for this like 3-hour epic or anything. And I don't know if they were aiming for that length, watching the pieces that are left. There are some deleted scenes that you can see in the trailer, definitely. But the pieces that are left and how they're executed doesn't reek of something that would have been, you know, 3 hours deep, immersive and skilled. It feels quickly done and done because they kind of just had to. There are some fantastic pieces, but it's not effective and as thoughtful anymore, and you have to kind of turn a lot off and just enjoy it it's enjoyable to watch, of course, and the action is fantastic, but especially the ending, but it doesn't linger as much as they kind of want because of the overblown soap opera thing that you correctly, in my opinion as well, said that this is it signals that it's going for too much even at the beginning, because they echo the scene from the first movie where Ho wakes up. And in this one, you get a slight recap of what happens in the first. And I would have loved if they kept it at only the shot of the burning money, the shot of Mark getting shot up. And then
the last few shots, yeah.
Exactly. But then they do a whole almost recap of the first film. And I kind of like, no, really didn't, dude. Really didn't. That would have been so effective. It's just these fragments of violence and burning money. So I think there's something wrong almost from the get-go. Like, I'm not comfortable with these filmmaking choices.
No, I agree. And back then, it's not like today's day and age where you've seen the film numerous times and then you can go into the second one. You know, back then, maybe some people have seen it at the cinema. They waited a whole year to see it again. Like, you don't really need to remind them how good the first film was, like with all that footage. Like, have the last few shots and then get them to concentrate on this by just reminding people, like, kind of, how good the first one was and showing all this kind of these shots from the first one. It's just daft. And like, and if it was 160 minutes or whatever, you know, Wu's kind of cut was originally of it, I don't think there's a lot in here that makes me think like, oh, that could have been better if it was extended. You still get Dean Shek, you know, acting, you know, ridiculously. You know, you still get these kind of very soap opera-ish scenes. You still get this, you know, very kind of overall melodrama. I think Wu's cut, you probably got more of that. Like, it's not like there's this kind of good, the bad, and the ugly kind of epic in there. It just seems like there's going to be more shit, basically, in there. Possibly some more action, but I mean,
one of the deleted scenes that's in the very long trailer is Chiang Fat, more scenes with him and Dean Shek. Chiang Fat trying to get the lung out of his shell. He apparently has a bird, like a small parrot or something, or whatever, yeah, and trying to play, he plays with that in front of him and sings in front of him and try to get him to engage that way. And that's a deleted scene, an example of more of their stuff that wouldn't really have helped, to be honest. But by the way, let's briefly talk Dean Shek. I had a reverse journey. Many people probably knew him from being a comedic actor, being a very grating comedic actor at times in kung fu movies and what have you. But this was my first Dean Shek role. I didn't know he had that journey before. I didn't know that he co-founded the studio that actually made this movie, Cinema City. So I'm looking at like a veteran actor. He looks kind of comfortable. And for half a movie, he does look comfortable. But his acting goes off the chart when he plays insane. It's where it becomes, it never reaches affecting because of how he acts in his emotional traumatic state. And granted, I don't know anything about emotional trauma of that kind, but looking at the acting here alone, it's not affecting when it goes those routes. But to be fair, in my opinion, when he isn't insane, Dean Shek looks comfortable and has
he's laid back.
And I like him in the action scene towards the end. So, but it is the mad acting that kind of grates on you.
It seems like he's putting these roles that just he's either too much. Like he's always too much. Whether it be a comedic role, whether it be trying dramatic, it's always too much. I mean, I haven't seen, you know, is it that Charlie Chaplin film with him in? I mean, I haven't seen.
That wasn't too bad. I mean, he's a dead ringer for Charlie Chaplin, I'll tell you that much.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, and I feel like I hear about things like this, and I feel like maybe there is more to him. Maybe he has got a good role somewhere, but it just seems like, yeah, he goes from mildly annoying to, you know, really annoying, kind of. That's his range, it seems, in most of the films that I've seen him in. But obviously, yeah, your entry to the, you know, Hong Kong cinema was Heroic Bloodshed. So, mm-hmm. as you said before, so that was kind of, this is your kind of thing. And for me, if I'd gone through that way, I think I probably first saw him in Drunken Master or Snake and Eat a Shadow, most probably. But even if I'd seen him in this first, I'd think, yeah, I mean, he seems quite cool. Seems, you know, quite very kind of, I mean, the role is kind of, he does well in the role. Apart from that first, you know, half hour or so,
I actually really like the character. He's an honorable character. He's got a code of ethics and honor. He even encourages Dick Long's Ho when he gets out of prison to go back in. You know, surrender. Don't go into this life again. And he himself has been out of the life for 15 years, you know, and all of that. So I liked, it's one of the few characters that I like, actually, when before the whole madness hits and what have you, that he's laid back and he's honorable. And for a while, even though this is melodramatic, there is some scenes where characters reconnect, but they reel in a few moments of reconnection. They don't do these huge embraces and huge swelling music all the time. It's one of those, like, smiles between characters rather than, and then, you know, when Kit and Ho meet when he's undercover and they don't embrace or anything, they smile, they say hi again, he says, I'm Billy, I'm going undercover, so make sure you call me Billy. And for a while it looks like, okay, John, good, that's about a tomorrow melodrama, which wasn't at all bad, is kind of exchanged for something slightly subdued, so good on you. But then the movie kind of goes off the rails and becomes kind of flimsy, to be honest. And soap opera melodrama is rarely affecting, to be honest.
No, I mean, it goes in a certain way. I mean, I think the main problem with the whole DJ thing is it's probably the majority of viewers of this film, I would say, is biggest gripe, because it's not... it's him as well, and it's his acting, but it's just so exhausting to watch, and in a bad way. It's like, it's fucking draining, and it's frustrating. And the worst thing is, it just keeps slowing the film down. And you're desperate. You're just desperate for the story to advance, and you know, someone give Charlie and Fat some guns, but we're there stuck with Dean Shek trying his hardest to pop the fucking veins in his forehead. Do you know what I mean? Like, you know...
He is method, you know, you got to give him that.
Well, I mean, yeah, I mean, look, like, he's going to explode. I mean, we have to look after him and we have to feed him, and it's just like, come on, baby. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's just, oh, man. It's just, yeah.
To be honest, Chai Fat is, you know, in these scenes, isn't that his most inspired either, acting against Dean Shek. I mean...
What are you supposed to do? Like, what
I know, but really, that's like he doesn't elevate the scenes. He can't. It seems like he's stuck with this melodrama, you know. And, you know, I never really cared for those two together, you know, and all of that. But let's talk Chai Fat a little. And, you know, he's not the only guy who just returns from the dead, not from the dead, but just returns as a new character. Even Xing Fuyon does. Xing Fuyon was on the other side of matters, so to say. Here, he's more on the side of Holes, Dick Long's Hole. In the first movie, he was one of the henchmen for Wise Lee, and he gets killed at the end, but... So it's like, hey, Xing Fuyon is back.
Good seeing back.
Yeah, exactly. I don't mind it. The lead into Chow's introduction is hilarious to me. That someone has made comic books or comic strips of the lives of Ho and Mark that are replicated comic strips from their replicated shots from the first movie.
Who was there to see that? No, this is another problem. This is a main gripe. The film is too meta for its own good. And to say that would think that it's somewhat intelligent, but it's not. It's basically, it wants to be a sequel set in the same timeline, set in the same world, and obviously forces the twin brother link, you know, through that. But it almost wants to play, you know, as well, like a story taking place in our world, where A Better Tomorrow was an immensely popular film, and flaunt its kind of influence. You know, you get the kids dressed as Mark Gore and you know, yeah, as you say, all these paintings and these artwork, and it's bizarre. And again, that's, it's just, again, like, I just don't know what we were thinking. Like, obviously, his heart's just not there, because it's just, it's not a logical, it just doesn't seem to me like a logical thing to think, oh, we'll put this in as well. Because it's almost like a wink to the audience, like, oh, yeah, the first film was so good. You remember that one, don't you? Yeah, that's why you're here. That's why you're sitting here now watching this fucking near 2 hour bullshit. Like, it's really bad. It's bizarre.
You know what would have sufficed? To just have, you could keep that character, a comic book character, but just have him show the photograph. And Ho asking, who's that? Oh, that's his twin brother. Didn't you know he had a twin brother? Fine, there you go. You know, Ken. You know, you didn't need to have these comic book strips from a character that you don't—that doesn't really matter in the long run either. So it's hilarious, though. I find it completely contrived and hilarious. I'd like that artwork; it looks great.
But... Oh yeah, it's fucking awesome, but it just doesn't—it doesn't need to be in the film. It just—it's just odd. I mean, I remember—I mean, I've seen the film first time, but I remember the first time seeing it, I just remember being, you know, hugely disappointed. When seeing this for the first time, you know, you might be saying, but I remember vividly, I remember travelling, you know, into Birmingham on the off chance it was in HMV and at a decent price, and the heavens shined on me and it was in stock, and I think it was less than £10 as well, which back then, you know, Hong Kong legends were like £20 a pop.
Yeah.
So travelling back home on the bus with a huge erection, thus missing several stops. Once I finally got back and watched it, I just didn't understand what had happened. I don't know what I'd been doing for two. I was just like, how does this, what went on? I thought my own approximation of the film, I think, before watching it, was that it's going to be similar to the first. It's probably a lesser film than the first, but it'll probably follow the same beats. It'll probably be along those lines. To have something that's this meta film, which, you know, has all these odd bits in it and these kind of this logic that just doesn't seem, you know, a normal human being could think of. It's just outrageous. It's just on its own terms. It's just a completely different fucking ballpark.
Let's talk New York, my friend.
Let's talk New York. The locales.
I love New York. I've been to New York. It was a great city. And
have you?
I have. I traveled once upon a time.
Tell me about it right now.
I was there for a couple of days. We live near Times Square, thankfully, so we were only there for 3 or 4 days. We've been in Boston prior. Only out for a week anyway. So it was good that we lived near Times Square so we could see something, you know, during our few spot days. And those were the times where DVD just hit and Laserdiscs were still out there. So the Virgin Mega Store on Times Square had both Laserdiscs and the DVDs, and that was like browsing heaven, you know, nerdgasm
right there. Experience right there.
You know, I would have fucked that little hole in the Laserdisc if I could. It's big enough, I'll tell you. But I think they frown upon those things in America.
No, you don't want to do that now, especially with like post 9/11 world, man. You don't want to go in there, stick your dick in a laser disc. That's just gonna be, you know.
I'll do that at home instead.
You're gonna get tackled then.
I wonder though, if they were smart enough to while they had Chang Fat in town to shoot an Autumn's Tale at the same time.
It's the same year, wasn't it? Yeah, so I wonder.
I think, though, that he had to do one film first and the other film second because his hairstyle is kind of different in An Autumn's Tale. It's consciously kind of, he's got a slightly different hairstyle. It kind of looks like he cut himself, essentially.
He might have just stayed there and they might have shot it.
Yeah.
It came back,
I don't know, but both movies were released in 1987. So I wonder if Mabel Jung and Alex Law had Chang Fat booked for An Autumn's Tale as well, while John Woo had him. But let's talk of maybe, aside from the final action scene, one of the most quoted scenes in the movie, the confrontation between Chang Fat and Louis Roth. Louis Roth as the Italian mob gangster who wants Chang Fat to pay protection and what have you, otherwise he'll blow up his restaurant. And this whole confrontation starts right out of fucking nowhere with the dubber of Louis Roth saying the immortal line while he throws a rice dish over the head of other restaurant visitors. This fucking fried rice stinks!
I don't know how you said that without laughing. It's ridiculous.
And it leads to this confrontation that I'm sure you have a ton of notes on, so I'll let you talk about that. But my favorite line from it nowadays, though, because I've forgotten about it, his associate, Louis Roth's associate, I want to talk to your greasy manager, all right?
Yeah, that's the one. I always forget that line. And I watch again, I'm just like, oh, what is he talking about?
Greasy manager.
I mean, it's just like, half hour kicks in, you've had a fairly quiet half hour. you go to the restaurant in New York, the fried rice starts to fry across the room. you know, and let's make note, the fried rice is of the stinky variety. Yeah. and we have easily the most unintentionally comedic, you know, English dialogue of all time, performed and written by what has to be aliens from another world's take on human interaction and how humans actually speak to each other. It's absolutely just like, come here, you, where's your bus? Like, why do they speak like that?
And then, manager, right?
And Chow comes over, and obviously, it's Chow dubbing himself, isn't it? It's got to be, you know, Chow. It's got to be, you know, that kind of, you just know straight away hearing his voice, and it's just like, I'm the bus, what can I do for you, sir? Like, it's just amazing.
That isn't even ridiculous. It turns ridiculous.
And then from there, like, I know English is not, you know, it's a first language. He does a damn good job at trying to, you know, keep up with English. But it's just the way that it's wrote. It's just insane. And then the rice gets chucked onto the floor in rage. And then Chang Fat starts picking it up with his hands and eating it off the floor. The floor looked a bit dirty, if I'm being honest, as well. They hadn't cleaned that. And for you, fried rice is nothing. For you, for me, it's my family. What is that?
Don't fuck with my family.
What is that about? And I love the fact that he puts the gun to his head as well, and the cop comes in, and he lets him, he's just like, no, he's like, put the gun down. And he's like, no, not before he eats the fried rice. He's like, I think you better eat the fried rice.
He's kind of relaxed about it, like it's the fifth time this week this has happened. Like, here we go again. Ciao, Ken. Put the gun down.
Fried rice incident. Oh, God, not again. They should just stop doing fried rice on the menu. All the fucking arguments it's causing. Like, jeez. Like, it is insane, man. Like, for me, that is just the pinnacle of the film. Like, that just sums up the film. Just complete, just bonkers. Just absolutely bonkers. It's just the way it's A, the actual dialogue that's written, and B, just the way it's delivered on both sides is amazing.
Yeah,
amazing, absolutely amazing.
I wonder if this was actually they have a black actor there, African American actor there. So I think this was New York, but it could have been Hong Kong. Lewis Roth obviously appeared in Hong Kong movies and was based out of Hong Kong. So, but I think it is a New York scene. I just have a feeling they got, not because he's black or anything, but I just have a feeling they cast him out of New York, yeah, the cop. But I'll tell you, Chiang Fat has a badass line here, though. You know, open your fucking mouth and eat the rice.
Rice!
I think that's rather badass, actually, because he looks genuinely pissed at that.
He is pissed off, man, so, yeah. Genuinely pissed off, man.
It's what it is. it's hard to take. In a fairly goofy movie that, again, we will talk about the fantastic action scene that has that. I mean, I find it, because it is so funny, I don't tune out of the scene, but clearly it doesn't do much good for the movie as a drama and like a felt piece or anything. It's and not because they're bad at English, it's just that as written, as you said, it's they just go on and on about the rice and how
that... I know, that's the thing that shocked me again. Every time I watch it, how long it goes on for, it's like the whole... It's like 10 minutes, like, the whole scene. It's insane how long it goes on for.
I mean, not to talk a lot about, again, Dean Sheck and Chiang Fat, but they have some dramatic interactions where Chiang Fat kind of breaks down in front of me and it wants Loom to break out of his shell. And normally Chiang Fat could elevate such a scene, but I don't know. And he goes for it. He cries while in front of Dean Sheck, but... I wouldn't say it's Dean Sheck's fault or anything, but this dramatic side plot or key plot or what have you, it never, early on, it seems like it never has a chance to be affecting, and their efforts, Dean Sheck's and Chiang Fat's, just, go in one ear and out the other. So it doesn't linger at all, despite Chiang Fat putting his all into it. And it's only affecting when obviously it turns into an action scene when finally Lung breaks out of his shell as Chiang Fat has, taken out all the assassins in the apartment.
Yeah. I mean, that scene as well, I just it's almost like DJ ruins it, because when Chow goes down the stairs backwards, like, shooting those dual pistols, like, that gives me goosebumps. Like, that is just, like, that... And that's what's kind of frustrating about the film as well, that it contains these moments that are just fucking just iconic. Like, some of the best, some of the best just the images that Wu's just ever captured on film are in this film. But, again, I don't know whether you know, so, which I always found weird about this film, like, the action scenes, like, the gunshot effects, like, they utilise almost kind of drawn-on little red squirts onto the film.
Yep. That is clearly, to me, it happens, like, twice. That is clearly, to me, a squib that didn't went off, and they didn't have time to redo it. The squib went off, but the blood didn't come out. So they painted on... the print, like, like blobs of blood, and it doesn't work at all.
I've seen it in other films in terms of, like, sometimes they do, it's like it's definitely added on, the effect is like post kind of filming, but they cut away quickly from it, so you get the effect, it's not, you get that effect, but it's not blatantly obvious it's an effect. But here it's like, it's lingered on because it's a slow motion shot, and the size of the blood doesn't change. It's like the same size, like, it's the same like blood patch as the guy kind of.
It's like John Woo's kids are painted on the print.
Yeah, it's like the red blob just kind of moves and it kind of engulfs the guy almost. Like, it's ridiculous. It's pretty distracting.
It's clearly that. I mean, I saw it on VHS already, but one thing I didn't see on VHS, which is a clever effect, you know, when Chiang Fat is in the car and he shoots the windshield of the car and the car crashes against the pole. The windshields are breaking. It's a superimposed effect.
Oh, I haven't even noticed this.
It's actually, I had to rewind it, and that's a split second thing, because that's rather clever, actually. You know,
I've never ever noticed that.
So they apparently didn't have time or could rig up that the windshield that would explode, or they couldn't really figure out how to crack the windshield only. You know what I mean? And that was rather good. It's literally like a painted on slight and animated effect that's on the screen for a very few frames, but it works like a motherfucker. So that's good stuff. Paint like that when John Woo's kids got a hold of the crayons and shit, they did good for that scene.
Yeah, they did well for that one.
Like, hey, what are you doing? Nothing. But hey, someone painted on this. So there you go. But again, I like these action scenes, and John Woo's heart is into them, and Chin Soo-dong, who action directed them, they are good. But what I also realized that whenever I feel a John Woo action scene is ever so slightly not as good as you might expect, they are obviously still damn solid for the Hong Kong cinema. You know, no one did action like Woo, and even if like the Caucasian henchmen look a bit, not threatening and all of that, they got the people they could. It's still extremely solid and even exciting to watch this bloodshed, because the scripts are always cool and big and all of that. So
yeah, I mean, Chang Yun-fat and Lung Ming, the actors, like the confrontation, like in the match just between those two. So ballsy, like kicking the guns across the floor and stuff. It's just so like, it's so Woo, like Woo 101, like kind of that code of conduct, that code of honor that is needed there. Like, he's not just going to blast him. They can't just shoot each other. They have to do it. You know, there has to be kind of that conduct there, that kind of brotherhood almost to, you know, that brotherhood to killing each other. It's amazing. And he again looks very iconic in the film, like another part of the film that really, really works. But should we get on to the final sequence now, talking about it? Like?
Absolutely. I mean, does the finale redeem the shortcomings? Absolutely not. But I'm ecstatic. I'm ecstatic we got this 15-minute action scene that is such a standout in Woo's career. I don't think we've had any... We've had extensive action scenes in The Killer and Hardboy, but I don't think I've ever thought to myself that this is a bloodbath. But what we get here is a bloodbath. And little trivia thing there, I'm sure many people know it. Parts of this finale plays on the TV in True Romance. Rosanna Arquette, or Patricia Arquette, fucking hell, I'm forgetting. She's watching the TV, and she's kind of doing karate sounds. So she obviously didn't know what she was watching. She probably just got a direction, like, you're watching an action movie, an Asian action movie. Okay. And what is playing is Dick Long and Xing Fion's kind of fight, axe samurai sword fight. And what Tony Scott said on the commentary was that Quentin, who wrote True Romance, told him to watch A Better Tomorrow 2 for thoughts and inspiration for the hotel shootout at the end of True Romance. And not that it's a carbon copy or anything, but the hotel shootout in True Romance is definitely Hong Kong cinema inspired, and very well too, because that kicks ass. The whole movie kicks ass. It's one of my favorite movies, True Romance. But that is Better Tomorrow too, and you can hear it, that it's English dubbed too. For it's one of those geeky references. And I think also they also feature, by the way, that scene you just described with that standoff between Chow and the assassin with the glass, the glasses. Go on, your notes on the finale, if you will.
It's amazing, but I mean, just talking about its influence, like you just kind of touched upon. Like, it seems to be like the first film seems to have more influence on Hong Kong cinema after it, whereas the second one is massively influenced on, like, you know, the West and kind of directors from other countries. I mean, it seems like this is the film that, like, it's been, you know, the influence can't be denied of it. You know, everything from Tarantino, like, you know, Reservoir Dogs and True Romance, you know, Shinichiro Watanabe as a Cowboy Bebop. Like, there's massive
really?
Influence.
Really? Really?
Yeah, yeah.
I've never seen that.
Massive influence, like, kind of on the shootout. So, I mean, I don't want to say anything, like, obviously, if you've ever seen it either, but there's massive influence there, kind of, in the series. And The Matrix and, you know, people, obviously, the kind of Wachowskis, they're big Asian cinema fans, but it seems that this film has more of a, you know, influence on kind of directors from other countries, whereas the first one seems to influence, you know, Hong Kong directors. But it's crazy, like, its influence just cannot be denied. But yeah, I mean, it's amazing. It's 15 minutes. I mean, we get everything. You get the insane explosions, you get the gunfights, we get, you know, a sword fight, axe fight. Literally everyone just is completely bloody and battered by the end of it.
I love that it goes boom quickly. You know, as soon as Chiang Fat, Dean Shek and Dick Long come up the stairs, you know, that's when Woo's challenge and Ching Sudong's challenge is to, you know, rig up so much squibs and so much explosions to go off in one go, you know, and have tons of people just time that, you know what I mean? rather than people just falling over. They are rigged up with squibs, a lot of them, and the blood just flies across the frame almost,
crazy.
You know.
Crazy.
And again, this is maybe the first movie out of two where John Woo nearly blew up Chiang Fat.
I love that.
That is real, that moment.
You can tell straight away if you didn't know the backstory. Just, you know, it's not this cool, you know, cool, calm, collected kind of like throwing it and walking away from the explosion. The guy, he literally shits himself as it goes off. He's and runs out of the frame. It's just amazing.
And they make it into a character bit in the next shot because he has a lot of grenades on him. So he's like, oh my God, that was a big explosion. I'm glad I didn't explode myself, essentially. So, I love that they just mow people down in this movie. And you don't get too many people in white, but the walls are white and they are blood splattered at the end of this mow down, you know, and Dick Long even takes out several people just in a hallway with a samurai sword. You know, it's so much fun to watch this, you know. One stunt that Chiang Fat thankfully didn't have to do was, you know, when he sets up the explosion in the cellar and then runs up the stairs and he thinks he's safe, and then the explosion is so great that the wall makes Chiang Fat's character fly across the room. Because the door literally flies out as well. Thankfully, a stuntman had to do that because that looked dangerous.
Looks really dangerous. Like, so close to that. Like, obviously, just all that was between the flames and him was like that bit of plywood from the door, like on his back. Like, that's insane. Like you're leaving like your arms and the back of your legs and everything just exposed. Just flames.
Yeah. But yeah, it's just great. I mean, it's. You know, if you had to watch it for anything, it's this. And I know people like this as a drama, and there's nothing wrong with that. And I have no problems watching this, and sitting through it, rather. I have problems while I watch it. Like, that's not good, that's not good, that's pretty good, but that's not good. Oh, my God, that was awesome.
Yeah, it's a mixed bag, man. It's a mixed bag, if anything. I mean, I think if you have a clear head as to what you get into, you're fine. But if you hop into the sequel, like, after seeing the first, you know, like I did with youthful blindsight, and think it's going to be a repeat of the first, you will be disappointed. But, I mean, it gets a marginal recommendation for me anyway, just for the iconic imagery and you know, the set pieces that do work and the fried rice scene. I mean, it's like, you know, EastEnders with grenades. It's, do you know what I mean? It's soap opera, but it's got all these, like, you know, fucking explosions in and stuff. So just check it out. I mean, just know that it's nothing like the first, or nothing like the third, for that matter.
Yeah, the third is a different beast too, and I've always been a defender of the third.
I like the third a lot, man. I like the third a lot. Like, absolutely, definitely better than this one. It's just a better film. It's not matching the first, but it's definitely a better film than this one.
I agree. All right, if you don't have any other notes,
that's
still the availability. It's kind of the same. I mean, it is available. It's with Fortune Star. It's on Blu-ray. They did a Blu-ray box set of the trilogy. That seems like, based on specs, that it again only has remixes, and I've heard the remix for Better Tomorrow 1 and 2. They are awful. You know, but thankfully the DVD box set is still out there. And I'm hoping, despite having a different cover than the DVD box set that I have, that they kept the original mono on the DVD, because they have remixes and mono, thankfully. So
they've got both on the remastered DVDs, because I've got the Hong Kong DVD. I think, yeah, they've got both of them. I've got the mono and the thing. I think I've got about three releases of it.
Yeah, I think it would be very unnecessary for them to go in there and, like, remove mono tracks and then repress it. I think it's just a matter of them changing up the cover. I have the one with Chiang Fat from A Better Tomorrow. The one I saw, it's a still, it's a white, it's a gray, like, outline of him.
Yeah, that's the one.
The one on Yes Asia is an image akin to the poster of A Better Tomorrow 1 with the faces, the profile.
Is that the Korean, really? I'm sure there's a Korean disc that is exactly the same as the Hong Kong disc.
I think it was the Fortune Star one, to be honest. But regardless, there is an imprint one on DVD. And I can almost guarantee that it's a better choice to pick that up based on the fact that the Blu-ray is surely not HD. And it's only has a remix. And the DVD is bound to be cheaper as well. So go get it. It has A Better Tomorrow 3 on there as well, obviously, and some deleted scenes from the Taiwanese version of A Better Tomorrow 3. So I got some extras on there. So that's it. On that note, therefore, next time, we might as well finish off the trilogy. And actually Tor.
And actually Ollie,
yes we are.
Yeah,
we'll actually talk the prequel to A Better Tomorrow. Yes, A Better Tomorrow 3, directed by Choi Hak. And that'll give us a chance to see how its Hong Kong edit plays versus the fairly longer Taiwanese edit. Because I have both in their entirety. So because the Taiwanese edit had a mainland China DVD release once upon a time, so it's out there. And because we don't care about connections or not, like connecting the movies and what have you, I'd opted for discussing another classic, 1988 classic, and it's Alfred Chung's classic noir thriller, On the Run, starring Yung Vu in his finest delicious acting performance, for my money's worth anyway.
Delicious. What a lineup you got, you lucky, lucky people, you.
Indeed. And there's endless such double bills to put together, but it's I thought I was in a Better Tomorrow kind of mood, so I thought like let's not wait to do the three, let's just get on with it. And the network has actually covered Therefore 1, 2, and 3 and a Korean remake,
and then after that A Return to a Better Tomorrow / Young and Dangerous. That's the next episode.
I like Return to a Better Tomorrow for it's worth it for Michael Wong ripping his shirt off in a Hulk-like moment. Like,
that's all you need in life.
So it's that's all I need in life to be content and sleep well at night, you know. for Michael to do well, and he did. He was so much fun in that movie. But we'll do that next time for next episode. But we'll hopefully we're all friends, listeners, after Tom and I destroyed A Better Tomorrow too. But you know, we love that you love it. If you love it, it's there's nothing wrong with enthusiasm. Your opinion is not wrong. Our opinion is not wrong. Your opinion is not right. Our opinion is not right. You know, so there's no definite yes or no in terms of that. So we welcome different opinions. Just be courteous about it. Like we have when we chat upon this movie. No, really, but we were honest and all that. But let's summarize the contact information again. This has been Podcast on Fire on podcastonfire.com. We have plenty of shows and bonus episodes on there. Check them out and make some picks and see if you like us. Email us for feedback, podcastonfire@googlemail.com. Join us over at Facebook. Get your asses off Snapchat, people. And get your asses over to Facebook and like our page.
No, put your asses on Snapchat. That's what they use it for again.
Stop putting your dicks on Snapchat and put your dicks on our page instead.
Yes, insert in our page. I don't know. It's got holes in it. I don't know. There's some O's on there or something.
You know, one dick in is one like, essentially. So
there you go. That's
maybe it's worth 5 likes. I don't know how it works.
I don't know. I don't know how dick maths works. Ken.
No, really. No,
I don't know.
We'll have to look into that. Facebook.com/POF Network. We also have a discussion group. You can reach that by clicking the link or on that site, or just typing in Podcast on Fire Network in the Facebook search box. Follow our tweets, twitter.com/podcastonfire. Follow my writing and video reviewing, sogoodreviews.com and sleazykvideo.com. And my tweets at twitter.com/sogoodreviews. Rate and subscribe to us on iTunes. And if you have something to say about the show and if you like it, please leave a small written review. 1 or 2 sentences will do. We'd be very happy to see that. And thank you to everybody who has done so. And finally, if you don't like downloading podcasts to your preferred device, there is the option of streaming them on Stitcher Radio. You can do that online. But there is also an app for your various Apple devices, iPhone, iPad, and as well as Android. Tom V Cinema, you have some
shit.
Pipeline. No, some shit in the pipeline.
Shit. Yep. Just keep your eyes out. I'm sure it'll go, you know, on the POF page or on my page or wherever. It'll go somewhere, so keep an eye out. It will be there.
It'll be on Snapchat.
Yes, it'll be on Snapchat. Just me holding an A4 pad with my penis out. That's what it'll be. With some words on regarding the film.
Eyes up here, the review, people.
The review, yeah.
But anyway, that's us for this episode. So I've been Kevin, and with me was the Moaner. Well, I'm a Moaner as well. Tom Kidd, I believe.
Cheers, guys.
No one will like us after this episode.
Nah, no one likes me, but...
but anyway, thank you for listening, and we out.